This is A Different Brilliant, an Aspect podcast focusing on the strengths, interests, and aspirations of the autistic community. Open, authentic, and engaging conversations about autism. Made for autistic people, parents, and carers of children on the autism spectrum. Welcome to A Different Brilliant.
Welcome to A Different Brilliant. I'm your host, Madeline Jane Lobsey, and I'm joined in the studio by Jennifer Lowe. Jen is, I want to say J-Lo, I'm already going there. Anyway, Jen is an autistic autism researcher who is completing her PhD in public health at the Olga Tennison Autism Research Centre, which is located at La Trobe at University in Melbourne. Jen received her autism diagnosis in 2018 at the age of 30. There you go, if anyone wants to know your age. There it is. And her PhD research focuses on the experiences of autistic adults at the end of life across the context of palliative care services, funeral services, grief, and bereavement. Jennifer has also conducted autism research within the context of healthcare, education, and aged care, and her work is being published in peer-reviewed journals, book chapters, and they have also presented at national and international conferences. Welcome, Jen.
Thank you, Madeline. Thank you for having me.
It's really great to have you here. And look, just for everybody's sake, we are going to talk about grief today. And I'm not sure that you can talk about grief without it being triggering. So it's definitely could, you know, this conversation could elicit all sorts of things as you're listening. And of course, you know, if anything, if you really do deal with anything in this conversation, then we have links for you to be able to get in contact with people that can support you. And they're on the podcast. So yeah, we're going to talk about grief today. And I think it's obvious to talk about it in the sense of losing a loved one or bereavement, but it actually can be expressed in all sorts of places for the autistic community. So we're going to have a look at an autistic experience of grief. So how about we start with some basics, Jen?
Yeah, sure.
And see if you can define grief, I guess, in the context of an autistic experience.
Mm-hmm.
And how come I'm saying it's important to look at it beyond just bereavement or the loss of a loved one?
So I think that it's really important to, when we're talking about going back to basics, understanding grief as a universal human experience. So regardless of whether someone is autistic or neurodivergent, there are things throughout the life course that we naturally grieve, and that extends beyond, you know, humans and into the animal world as well. We can see that it is something that is universal. So one of the other really important aspects of not just bereavement, but the concept of loss and losing something or someone, and understanding that not all losses result in grief. So grief isn't necessarily a automatic response. So there are other factors that contribute to whether or not a loss or a bereavement, for that matter, results in the process of grieving or the expression of grief.
Wow, that's a big deal, the thing you just said, because I think I'm already hearing for myself the amount of assumptions I make.
Yes.
Based on my own personal experience of the thing. Or that you should grieve or you should be a particular way when something happens.
And I think the underlying assumptions that everyone has going about our, you know, everyday lives, grief and loss and bereavement is really an opportunity to pause. And when we're either looking at it from our own autistic experience or the experience of someone else, it's really about understanding what did that person or that pet or that companion or that thing mean to that person, and what are the ramifications of that loss, so to speak.
Yeah, wow, my brain's going brrr with everything that you're saying, and I'm connecting it back to situations in our own family where our children saw our pet die in front of them. about a year ago, and we're all autistic ADHD. So there I got three kids, three very different experiences of it. Yeah. And I remember vividly one of my kids saying, that was my only friend. I've now got no friends, in this very sort of straightforward, matter-of-fact way.
Yes.
And it, did that hit me, because I was like, that's not my experience of this.
Yes.
And I think that's exactly what you're saying.
And so often we go into a situation with a preconceived notion of what it's going to be or what it should look like. And I think for anyone who, particularly for me, my personal experience being late diagnosed, looking back at circumstances and thinking, oh, that's why it was different for me, or that's why I felt not like everybody else, and questioning those the assumptions, but also the expectations of the people around me. So there is a notion that, you know, if you lose someone really close to you, that that automatically means that you're going to cry, or that you're going to want to be surrounded by people. And for a lot of people on the spectrum, that's, you know, not...
That's way worse.
Yeah. Mm. And I remember one of my research participants saying, you know, the worst thing about attending his father's funeral wasn't the fact that his dad was dead, but the fact that there were so many people there and they all had social expectations of him that he wasn't able or prepared to meet, because he was grieving in his own way. And that is, you know, that's been my experience having interviewed so many autistic people over the last 7 years. It really is that universal, the truth that we do grieve, but not in the way that other people might expect us to.
Yeah, I guess it's probably a good time for you for people listening, because I'm thinking too, like when I'm grieving, I'm autistic and I want deep pressure. I want hugs. Mm-hmm. I want to feel like I'm in my body, and I have kids, so I want to hug them, but that's absolutely not what they want.
Yes.
And we have to juggle that within our household. So I think it would be powerful for you to sort of paint a picture of what are some of the experiences, or how do people, I guess, process loss in an autistic way? It's give people some idea of the variations.
Yeah, sure. So there's this concept in the literature and more broadly as well, when we talk about anticipatory grief. So it's the grief of something that you know is coming. So this can apply to things, you know, for example, finishing primary school and moving into high school. There is a grief that's anticipated with the end of perhaps leaving friends or leaving a familiar place. And then in terms of bereavement, there's if someone, for example, has a terminal illness or a diagnosis where you understand that their trajectory is that they are going to die. And I use the word die and death very purposefully. One of the things that came out of the research was that there is a tendency in our, you know, socio-cultural context where we avoid saying the words dead and death and dying, and we use euphemisms like pass away or, you know, they're gone or they're lost. And for a lot of autistic people who have...
It's like they're not lost. I know they're not lost.
A literal interpretation, yeah. Like they're not lost. Where, yeah. You know, they're at the cemetery, or they're in their,
urn.
Ashes. Exactly, yes. Yeah. So I think it's really important just to sort of, you know, for some people the words death, dying can be confronting, but I think it's just important to note for people who are wired for a literal interpretation, it just is what it is, you know, and it's not meant to be provoking or triggering or anything like that. It just is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's very, very good. Okay, so when someone dies or something dies, I know, so we started to touch on it, but what have you seen over all of your experience with autistic community about the ways people have processed that?
So I want to say not the word isolation, because that doesn't really do it justice. It's more of a processing in solitude and having this sort of approach of self-preservation and knowing that you're going through something that is perhaps new if it's the first time that someone has lost, you know, for example, like for a lot of children, the first loss that they experience is a pet, as you've described in your household, or a grandparent, so someone older in the family. So for many, that is their first experience. And not only is it a difficult situation, no matter how many times you've been through it, but that first time in particular, it sort of sets a blueprint for what you know is going to work or not work for you to process grief in the future. And so I think that those first few experiences in particular are really important. And
when you say really important, you mean the way those around them, like parents or educators or people in their life, give space or navigate them being able to process.
Yes, absolutely. And even to take it one step further than that, I have spoken to a lot of people in the funeral industry, in the crematoria industry, in the cemetery industry. And one of the things that they understand, having, you know, worked in their role day in, day out, supporting families, is that autistic people really do have different needs and different ways of going about what certain ceremonies or, you know, dare I say the words ritual and routine, because there are a lot, whether it's, you know, religious or cultural or what have you, there are, you know,
the way things are done.
Yeah. Every family, every community has their own expectation about the way things should be or would, you know, prefer to be done. So.
Yeah. I think it's really important if we step back to that first experience and giving space. And I also just thought about my son. He was probably about 6 or 7 and I found him hysterically sobbing in his bed. And I couldn't work it out what was going on. And after some time, he started talking about his favorite teddy bear, the one that he sleeps with all the time, like his important personal thing. And he'd somehow worked out at some point that he was going to die and the teddy bear would be left alone. And who was going to look after the teddy bear when he was gone?
Yeah.
And he was devastated. That he was fundamentally responsible for, I'm going to abandon this teddy at some point.
And I think that that's really the insight that comes with an autistic person's first understanding of, call it mortality, you know, that that things are finite in this life. I remember my own personal experience with that, and it really did blow my mind, because the way that I guess it's not something we talk about every day. And so unless it happens or unless there is some sort of catalyst for having that conversation, it's not something that people are comfortable with. And even when people do know it's happening, there is a tendency to skirt around it.
Or, yeah, it's not literal.
No.
And not to say anything about faith or religion, but in those contexts, it's spoken about in a way that's not literal.
No. And the... I don't want to say the risk, but I guess sometimes there are well-meaning or, you know, well-intended anecdotes that are, you know, given to children as a way of explaining things. And there was one example, a research participant said that that their understanding was that when someone dies, they go to heaven and heaven was in the sky. And so the first time that person got on an aeroplane, she expected to see everyone that she knew in the clouds, in the sky. And that was genuinely her understanding. And so that was really, really upsetting for her to know that she had been
told. Couldn't see them.
Yeah, for better of a word, a lie or an untruth, you know. And so I think that that line between not wanting to cause more distress but also giving factual, real, tangible facts and, you know, things like seeing, and I don't know what your experience was with your pet, but seeing the body is really important for some autistic people. And again, I just want to stress, this is this is not a one size fits all. And I know that that sounds very cliche. but
no, it's critical. It's critical to know every person's experience is unique.
Yes. And so some people want to know, and the level of information need or desire is very variable. So I remember sitting at my nonna's bedside, so my Italian grandmother, who the closest person in the world to me, and what I wanted in that moment was information. And at that point, I didn't know that I was autistic, so I didn't have a framework for that. But I thought to myself, I don't think anybody else in this hospital is reading about the side effects of morphine at their loved one's bedside. But for some reason, that was comforting to me. And I can see in hindsight, it was my need to understand what was happening, like what was actually physically happening. And for some people, that's too overwhelming. And that's also completely fine. But it may also go in phases that you know, sort of rabbit hole down for information and gather. And once you feel comfortable, then you move on to the next stage of the process or the next thing that you don't quite understand. So all those really tangible things where I think services and broader, you know, organizations within the community to have a more holistic understanding of what people may need, it doesn't necessarily make sense to them or make sense to the majority, but there are some things that, you know, will benefit. So if a child wants to see a body, it's not, it's not taboo. It's not hidden. It's not, it shouldn't be something
strange, something wrong.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I've gone on a whole side quest conversation in my head about this. But anyway, I'm coming back. So, look, I think, you know, we could spend a long time continuing to deep dive, but I think about actual bereavement. But I think it's also important to look at a more broader picture. So if we have a look at everyday losses, just let's say a little bit more about that, losses outside of bereavement.
Yeah.
What kinds of things do we see?
I think we take for granted that a lot of the things that we feel keep us safe or keep us sort of regulated on a daily basis, the loss of those things can actually really make a huge difference. So whether that's as simple as, you know, someone's morning coffee or someone having a certain cereal or, you know, the route that they take to school or to work, all of these little things, they can have a cumulative impact. And so maybe by the end of the day, something that seems quite minor and seems quite inconsequential actually is the tipping point for feeling a whole lot of grief for things that either no longer exist or you don't have access to anymore, or your favorite, you know, product stops being made, or they change the recipe for something. And so these little milestones throughout, you know, an autistic person's day that signal safety, that signal sameness, they really can have a big impact as well.
Far out. I mean, there's a lot. I think it's so good, the thing you just said, because I wouldn't have put grief and those things together.
So when I was looking at the dictionary definitions for grief, the same sort of words keep popping up. So despair or sorrow or distress. And when I think about the intensity of emotions that someone who's neurodivergent can experience, something that someone else may say, oh, I feel a little bit sad, actually, it's really distressing, genuinely very distressing. And so regardless of what that looks like for someone on the outside, if you're feeling that distress, it's completely valid. And for those around you who are closest to you to acknowledge that is the most healing thing that can happen to it's not to get over the grief, but it's to integrate it into your life, to find a new sense of normal and a new sense of stability and a new sense of safety. So whether or not, you know, things and people that are really important to us, they can't be replaced as such. But if you look at the function or the deeper meaning of what something means to someone, you can usually find a meaningful way to integrate that person or that, you know, animal or pet into someone's life in a different way.
That's so clever. That's so clever. I want to see if we can try and get this real, right? Because the other part of my brain, which is ADHD, wants to change things all the time. So I'm constantly wanting to change the furniture and swap it out. And, you know, anyway, that's a big deal to my kids. And anytime I've gone to throw a bit of furniture out, which might be a 20 buck cupboard from Marketplace, right? They've been really mad and upset. And I was like, what is going on here? Like, it's a cupboard. You don't even use it. And anyway, do you want to say something about that before I go on?
I was just going to say, I feel like one of the common themes as well that I have noticed across contexts is that change is completely fine as long as it's my choice to change, or I'm aware of the change, or I have notice of the change. So like you, I might get really excited that I've got something new or done something different. But if other autistic people in my house don't know about it, then it isn't necessarily met with the same enthusiasm
I've learned that the hard way. Like, and I've done it again. Like, I've done it more than once and gone, oh, I've done it again. Anyway, one of the things I just heard out of what you said was I had this pile of cushions, right? And they were getting disgusting. So I just was like throwing them out. In the, you know, council recycling thing, and one of my kids was really not okay.
Yeah.
And went and dragged one of the cushions out and took it up to their room, and then I found it months later.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I stopped being like, what is the deal over the cushion, and I actually asked what you're saying, I didn't ask it that way, but I basically said, why do you care about this? Like, what? How does this function in your life? And they said, for years, I played with my brother and sister and built cubbies with this.
Yeah.
When I think about how much I love my siblings, and when I think about playing with my siblings, I think about those cushions. And I'd thrown the siblings in the bin, you know what I'm saying, with the cushions. And I never put it together.
And I think that there is such variation in the importance that is placed on, like, tangible, concrete objects as well. So for some people, you know, cleaning out the estate of someone who has died is a really overwhelming process, and there isn't really room for gathering the things that, you know, have meaning to them, or perhaps that person died suddenly and they haven't had a chance to have those conversations about who will, you know, who, what gets passed on to who, essentially, and why. And so there are a lot of meaningful objects, and sometimes it's a matter of practicality that you can't take that, you know, person's entire house, or you can't take that person's entire collection of something, but they still have meaning. And so it's about how do you balance the need to have those possessions that are imbued with that person, essentially, you know, for like something that I liken it to, for any Harry Potter fans or anyone who's watched the movies, like that notion of a Horcrux. You know, if I have my grandmother's wedding ring, it's not just a ring or a piece of gold. Like, my grandmother wore that on her finger every day. And so it has a different level of meaning. And so I completely understand, you know, what your kiddo is saying about the cushion. Like, that's memories. And there is a point where, you know, the collection of those kinds of items can, you know, affect function and affect someone's ability to process. But I think that, there's absolutely no harm in allowing the time and the space for that. And
you got to say that again, because I think everybody could do with hearing that more than once, that there's actually no harm in allowing for someone to process things, including keeping things in the way that they need to.
Yes, in their own space and in their own time, and without the additional pressure of other people's expectations. And I know that life doesn't stop when something happens. You know, if there's a major loss or a major trauma, the world doesn't stop. It keeps going. But there is a way to, and it comes back to what we were saying before about that self-preservation, that sort of, processing in solitude where you take the time where you can and in the way that you can.
Mm-mm. Yeah, okay. So then let's talk about the people surrounding grief, like mm-hmm. the people that may not, well, sometimes you're grieving yourself too, but let's talk about what you know or what you've discovered, the evidence that you have for strategies that are helpful in those moments.
So I think that to put it into context, I had a funeral director say to me once that regardless of whether someone is neurodivergent, when someone is grieving and at the start of that grief journey or process, that their ability to plan or make decisions or access their cognition in the way that they normally would, it's just not the same. And so when you put that in the context of, existing challenges that may already be there for someone, it takes on a new level of significance and a need for being patient and gentle and kind, being a nice human. People don't walk around with, a sign saying, I've just lost someone. And so it is invisible. And like so many of the needs in the autistic community, you can't see it and you don't know. So
having said that, how might we recognize it? So if it's not like there is no sign saying that, then how might we recognize that someone is grieving?
So for people who are closest to the person, I think it's always helpful to have that baseline. And I think that's where advocacy comes into it. So if the person isn't, in a position where they feel comfortable or have the capacity to advocate for themselves during that phase, it's about setting up the system. So is the child in primary school, high school? Is it university? Is it a workplace? Is it, TAFE? All those, thinking about the scaffolding that surrounds that person and what accommodations can be made and to make it the easiest transition possible. And that whatever strategies that person or that family unit or that wider community use to really build on what you know already works for that person. So
do more. Like, let's say, what really works for that person is when they arrive at work or when they arrive at school, having 10 to 15 minutes of solitude to regulate before they go into the environment. You're saying that things escalate during grief or can be felt more intensely, and that whatever strategies work, it's good to lean towards those even more. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. So it's okay to take a time out, or it's okay to have different needs now than what you may usually ask for. And it's about negotiating those, but, not in the moment where things feel really overwhelming. Mm. And I know that, one of the most, commonly used phrases is, grief comes in waves. Mm. And if you just think about that in a really literal sense, when you're under the water, you don't know it's a wave. All you know is that you can't see, you can't hear, you can't breathe. It feels really scary. And that's not the moment to be making decisions. That's not the moment to be setting up supports. Mm. And so if there is a loss that can be anticipated, it's really important to be proactive, as well, whether it's, for yourself or on behalf of someone else.
Okay, so let me ask you something that may be controversial, for some people, is, when you're a parent or an educator, or just I think a human being, when you see someone going through something, mm-hmm. our immediate pull is to try and make it better.
Mm-hmm.
That's how do we fix this? How do we stop this? How do we make it better? What's your advice on that? Like, is that what there is to do? Because maybe it's about allowing them to feel it, even if it's very painful.
Yes. And sitting with that, I think, can be challenging. I know that there are times from my own experience where I feel betrayed by my own defenses, so to speak. You know, like, why am I feeling that? And I didn't give myself consent to feel that in this moment, you know, like things that arise unexpectedly. But for supporting someone else, there isn't the fact is that there isn't anything you can do. And so often when people are, you know, angry or heightened or being really honest, you often hear people say, it's not going to bring them back. It's not going to, mm-hmm. it's not going to make it better. And I think it's being okay with that truth. And there is no band-aid solution. And none of us are any the wiser, you know? Death really is an equalizer when it comes to being human. It's, you know, the mortality rate is 100%, always has been, always will be. And nobody knows. And everybody deals with that in their own way, whether that's, you know, spirituality or a sense of, you know, being with nature, or it's whatever brings comfort. And it is familiar to people, or what feels right and authentic to them.
Yeah, and maybe even just the space to be where they are.
Yes.
Which might not have anything to do with comfort.
Correct.
Yeah.
It's that thing of, you know, it's not fair and we don't know the answers and we don't know why it happened and there isn't an answer. And so often, you know, I was that child, like, why? 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 And when there are no answers, it's really frustrating because all of a sudden the people and the adults that you looked up to give you that guidance, they don't know either. And and so you sort of go, who's in charge here? Who set this up?
In a world of rules where everything about life is you do it this way, you do it that way, and this is the rule, and this is the scientific rule, and this is the theological rule, and this is, you know, like there's rules for everything. And, yeah, I think that's what I'm taking away from this is there actually aren't any.
No.
Yeah.
There are certainly, you know, I guess you could call them, I don't want to say major events, maybe milestones is a better word, where you know that your life is not going to be the same again. And that is really sad and it can be really frightening, but it also doesn't have to be because there's two sides of the coin. So every, you know, again, it sounds cliche and there are so many of those sorts of tidbits or sayings in this space, but you know, when something ends, it's the beginning of something else. And however long someone needs to stay in wrapping up that ending is completely up to the individual. There's nothing that I don't believe anyone else can say or do that's going to hurry it along, so to speak. And so it's really about walking with that person through it, and you know, the ups and the downs of it.
And is there anything else you think would be really valid or important or great for people to hear in all of your experience and research?
I feel like, and we touched on it in the very beginning, I think that one of the main takeaways is to really question the assumptions that we have and that we hold, and whether someone was diagnosed at a younger age or you know, later in life, there are assumptions that we all pick up along the way. And who says that it has to be that way? Or why can't it be a different way if that's what makes the person feel safe or more stable in the face of loss?
Yeah. And are there any sort of, I guess, good resources that you know, like good books on grieving or good places that people could contact?
So I know that when I started my PhD, that someone that I interviewed said that it was very rare that you would Google a topic and absolutely nothing would come up. And so I have seen over the last few years that there are increasingly resources that are coming through. I know that a lot of
for autistic people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I, you know, have sort of bought them as they've come out along the way. And, you know, some of these books are like tailored social stories in the form of a picture book for children. And I, you know, I read it and I go, I wish I had that when my grandmother died, even though, you know, I was an adult already, because it's just, it it's in language that my brain can process, and it makes it feel okay, like someone who understands me is talking to me. So I know that there are a multitude out there. I know that some families also prefer to make their own with the circumstances, because when we're talking about loss, there are so many variables, you know, like someone coming to the end of their life or a really old pet versus something that's unexpected, you know, they get bitten by an insect or something like that that's completely out of the blue. So sometimes it is more appropriate or more, preferred to make your own. So
yeah, I think that's really smart advice. And there's plenty of information on how to build a social story, even if you Google it, that you could make one for yourself.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anything else you want to let the people listening know before we wrap it up? Anything else you'd like to say?
I feel like this is one of those topics that is quite divisive in a lot of ways, and there are a lot of preconceptions that there needs to be some element or level of protection around loss and death and dying. And there are movements now in the public health space and in the community, like community-driven initiatives. If we think about the way that death was handled, you know, 100 years ago, people died at home. It wasn't a medicalized and institutionalized sort of process the way that it is now. So it's sort of getting back in touch with what we used to know before all of the systems came into place, and not to be afraid just because a facility or an organization has a policy, that there are ways to do things in a way that you're comfortable with. And also, I might add, a lot of services that are really willing to help meet the needs of the neurodivergent community.
For sure. And yeah, I know definitely that there are amazing, amazing funeral directors and services. Yeah. So, well, look, Jen, I really do want to thank you for being willing to research for many people the unthinkable, and being willing to go there and have the conversations that other people don't want to have and find out. And we thank you for every minute you sat there interviewing and typing your PhD. And thanks for being on the podcast today.
Thank you so much, Madeline, for bringing awareness to the subject. I think it's so important. So, yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to A Different Brilliant, an Aspect podcast focusing on the strengths, interests, and aspirations of the autistic community. If you would like to learn more, visit our website, aspect.org.au, to listen to past episodes or send us a message. Make sure to like or subscribe to A Different Brilliant on your podcast app.